The Gateless Gate, Case 14. Nansen saw the monks of the Eastern and Western halls fighting over a cat. Seizing the cat, he told the monks, "If any of you can say a word of Zen, you will save the cat." No one answered. Nansen cut the cat in two. That evening, Joshu returned to the monastery, and Nansen told him what had happened. Joshu removed his sandals, placed them on his head, and walked out. Nansen said, "If you had been there, you would have saved the cat." Oops. I seem to have disappeared.
Barry, I can hear you.
You can hear me? My
yes.
Video went away. Now, okay, now I've got it back.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No, I'm having trouble with Zoom too today.
So I wanted to choose the talk today, a koan that might be relevant to the topic of conflict, since there's so much in and around us these days. But that's not easy to do because Zen koans don't typically address anything that we would usually treat as conflict. They may address an inner sense of conflict or doubt, but the idea of outer conflict is not something that gets talked about directly. And in this koan, we have monks arguing over a cat. And I think it's hard not to feel that it's presented in a way that whatever the argument is about, it must be a pretty empty and foolish argument. And sometimes you hear commentaries that try to imagine what could they be arguing about that is worth arguing about. And I guess the best I've heard or come up with is monks are asking, is it okay to keep a cat in the kitchen to kill mice? Or is that violating the precepts? I suppose that's plausible, but still, in the realm of things, seems pretty trivial. We could certainly, if we wanted to, come up with a lot better things for them to be arguing about. The monks might be wondering about whether they should be truly self-sufficient, or should they be taking patronage from rich warlords or the emperor. Is that really the same as being a mendicant monk and collecting alms to collect a rich stipend every year from the emperor? That might be something to argue about. Or maybe they could argue about, I came here thinking this monastery was run by a teacher who is a living Buddha, but he looks like an ordinary man to me. Is that a problem, or is that the point? Maybe you could argue that. Maybe they could argue about the role of women. Should the monastery be open to women as well as men? How about the relation of the monastery to the community? Is it enough that we perform services for the merit of deceased community members, or do we owe something more to the people in the countryside where we live? Should monks be engaged in any kind of good works or public support practices that engage and support the poor of the community? Or are they supposed to just devote themselves to a life of contemplation? That might be worth arguing about. I think we could certainly have lots of arguments like that in a community today. Maybe they wouldn't be arguments, but they're certainly genuine issues and conflicts that might be worth a debate. But we never see it presented that way, certainly not in a koan. There, it's much more like those foolish monks are arguing over how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, and Nansen wants to put an end to all that nonsense, right? So he grabs a cat, threatens to kill it. This obviously is a bit of a fairy tale. Nansen is not known to have been leading a sect of knife-wielding ninja monks, you know. A monk is not going to be carrying a knife, not going to be killing, vegetarian monks are not going to be out killing animals to make a point. But it's a fairy tale, and it, in a way, tries to show what does it take to make a point. And I think that one of the points he wants to make is that monks arguing is as destructive to the unity and living function of a sangha as it is to kill an innocent animal, right? That the arguments are really what's killing the cat, what's killing the sangha. That we're dividing the sangha is as much a crime as cutting an animal in two. You're disturbing the peace. And Nansen challenges the monks to say a word of Zen and save the cat. And teachers now might ask a student, well, what would you say? What would be a word of Zen? And in the story, the monks all sort of freeze, right? Nobody can say anything. What's a word of Zen? And again, they are frozen because the immediate response we have is the word of Zen is something special, something very esoteric, or something that we have to have our Dharma eye open in order to be able to finds, you know, the secret password that's going to unlock this dilemma for us. In a way, it's analogous to someone asking you, show me your original face before the birth of your parents. Right? What's that? Where am I going to look for that? Right? And so again, the monks fail to recognize that Immediacy is what's being called for. And that's reflected in what happens when Joshu comes back and hears this story. Nansen doesn't even have to ask him to say a word of Zen. Just as he hears the story, he takes his sandals off and puts them on his head and walks out. Now, I'm told that putting your sandals on your head in China at the time was a typical act of mourning. It's something you might do as as an act of bereavement, the way we would talk about putting ashes on your head. So Nansen, hears the cat has been killed and immediately makes a sign of bereavement. That the immediate appropriate response is his word of Zen. Now, if you don't know that putting your sandals on your head is a sign of bereavement, it makes nonsense sound more like Harpo Marx, that he suddenly does this completely irrational, weird thing in response to the cat being done. And I think that when I first heard this koan, it was often as if he's doing something wild and irrational and upside down, something like that, and that's what's Zen about it, right? That's, I think that would be a travesty of a word of Zen, to just do something that so stinks of Zen, stinks of something that is, wow, look at me, what a wild and crazy guy I am that I'm doing this thing, putting my shoes on my head, right? That shouldn't be what we mean by Zen at all. As I thought about the story and the context of what's going on these days, it might be much more equivalent to saying, hearing that the cat was dead, Joshu took a knee, made an immediate gesture of respect, mourning. See, I think that what happens in too many of these Zen stories is the presumption is that differences really don't matter. And what counts above all is to restore a sense of unity or immediacy or oneness or something like that. But this real circumstances of our life keep reminding us that there are differences that make a difference. I seem to remember a story from some years back where a an American teacher, male teacher, was confronted by some of his female students about the role of women in the Sangha and how they were being treated by the men. And so they tried to confront the teacher about that in a public talk. And the teacher's response was to say, "We are all women." This did not go over well. We could call that kind of response a flight into oneness, right? It's a kind of denial of a difference that makes a difference, and trying to evade those differences by saying, there's no difference between men and women here. We're all one, we're all the same. Monastery is where all differences are erased and we are all part of one seamless whole. Well, that's a good ideal in a sense, but not if it is used to cover up real problems and real differences. And we hear that sometimes when people respond to being told Black Lives Matter with All Lives Matter. And yes, that's right. But to say that is to, again, have a kind of defensive flight into sameness. It's to ignore the fact that race is an issue. You can't simply declare racial differences are over. It's probably a truism that the surest way to be caught by a prejudice, whether it's racial or gender, is to start with the assumption that you have none, right? Another kind of flight away from differences that really make a difference. It's hard to go to koans and get much help with dealing with those kinds of differences. Certainly there are koans that talk about not being trapped in oneness. But they're much more likely to talk about the diversity of nature and the manifestation of difference in all sorts of particulars than they are to talk about genuine conflicts that need to be addressed. Part of our discussion of Philip Bromberg's work on multiple self-states is meant to be a reminder within the context of Zen that diverse and conflicting elements are inevitably going to exist within us as individuals. And it's not the point of practice to try to eliminate those differences or smooth them out and achieve a kind of homogeneous unity. Rather, the metaphor is we need to find a place at the table for all these different self states. The goal is not to make them the bad ones go away. It's not to make all of the different ones blend into a single state so that we're the same with everybody and in every situation. It's to acknowledge that we're multiple. And it's only by acknowledging that that we can begin to deal with the differences that make a difference within ourselves and within our relations to others. And that has to take place at the social level as well as the personal and psychological level. I grew up in a generation where a lot of lip service was paid to the ideal of the melting pot, right? The idea that America is the kind of place where immigrants from all over come, but then they're put into this melting pot, right? Where all the differences are melted down and what you get is some new homogenous kind of American citizen, right? That they're melted down so their differences disappear and now we all become the same thing. And there was a virtue in that kind of ideal, in that it said, wherever you came from, you can be an American, you can be part of this. But the dark side of that was to say, ignore, forget the differences. Differences won't matter. Whereas in fact, not very far behind the scenes, differences mattered an awful lot in terms of opportunity and prejudice and how you were treated in this society. So it's only when we get past that image of kind of defensive oneness that we get to really examine, well, what differences really matter and how people are being treated here. I think a zendo, and particularly a monastery, is all too easily a kind of place where we can go to try to retreat from difference. A place where we go where, you know, in some cases, everybody takes off all their street clothes, puts on a robe, and all begins to look alike, where people shave their heads so that they all, again, have this uniform look. And even in a lay sangha like this, it's very easy for us to all feel like we leave our differences at the door and come and participate in this shared activity where how we sit and how we interact really is a function of what's going on inside the zendo, not a function of what we've brought from the outside. If a word of Zen means bringing forth in all its immediacy your own personal response or reaction, that response is going to be conditioned by your culture, your gender, your race, your personal history. A word of Zen is not supposed to be something generic, right? If we only think about Zen as the kind of a melting pot for ego, then our word of Zen is going to be very generic. You know, it'll be just slapping the floor or shouting, you know, cuts or something like that. You know, some generic Zen sounding thing that we've taken out of an old book. Right? That's not your word of Zen, that's the word of some dead Chinaman, right? So find the word of Zen, but make sure it's yours, personally.